From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, foreign policy contributor Art Sear talks about the continuing saga of Russian meddling in U.S. elections and our fascination with it.
Among other things, it shows our fascination with technology. Intelligence is a combination of human intelligence and technological intelligence. We have a natural affinity for things electronic.
Later, how companies are fighting each other to attract and retain the best employees.
There's always been a war for the best talent. And actually, right now, we're back in a full-fledged war for talent in the United States and really mostly globally.
And Sculpture Milwaukee elevates public art in the city, but the city itself is art.
Public art is all around us. And I would hazard a guess that everything that we see in our urban environment is designed by someone. So therefore, everything is art in some way.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The former chairman of Donald Trump's presidential campaign, Paul Manafort, agreed on Friday to cooperate with a special prosecutor investigating Russian meddling in U.S. elections. It's unknown yet exactly how that will shape the Mueller investigation, but the decision sent shockwaves through Washington and beyond.
It is not the only recent news involving Russia, which is embroiled in a long-running espionage controversy with the United Kingdom. Art Sear of Carthage College is our foreign policy contributor, and he's with us in the studio to help analyze the state of things. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me back, Mitch. It's always a pleasure and a tonic, and I always learn something.
I always learn something as well.
Well, I certainly hope so. Otherwise, I might not get invited back.
Hopefully, we can keep up our streak here. Let's start with Russia and the continued controversy and concern over potential Russian meddling in the U.S. elections. We've been talking about this for months, and it seems astounding, actually, that this continues to be an issue, especially as the next round of elections are coming.
Well, it's become immersed in the very intense partisan warfare of Washington, hasn't it, and in congressional interchange. So in that sense, it's not surprising. And Russians, if you live long enough, you tend to see some things coming around again. And one of my earliest memories as a child through into adulthood and right up until the end of the Cold War, but especially in the 50s and 60s, was the danger of communism and the Red Menace, which was real. The Cold War was a very real conflict between two great superpowers. But in terms of our domestic politics, we clearly overreacted, and indeed careers were destroyed, certainly limited, but in some cases destroyed. In Hollywood, famously, also in academia. And there's a whiff of that now, demonizing, I think partly a legacy of the Cold War, demonizing the Russians.
I wonder if one of the issues now is how much easier it is to be effective with propaganda or misinformation than it was in the days of, you know, Radio Free Europe or you know, Radio Moscow.
Yeah. I think that's a very good point. And following one of your leads, Vladimir Putin, a very durable leader, I think we'd all agree, and a very influential one, given the weakness of his economy and the political threats that he faces at home, very real ones and potentially lethal ones. He has said, among other things, on television and with a globe, if you spin a globe anytime and put your finger anywhere on that globe, if it's populated, you can rest assured the Americans are meddling, intervening, trying to influence, overstating, obviously, but not all that much. Starting with World War II, we've become very active and proactive in many positive ways in other parts of the world, but also we try very hard, not as much as during the Cold War, but certainly we try in selected cases to influence what's going on in other countries. Among other things, it shows our fascination with technology. Intelligence is a combination of human intelligence, as you and our listeners know, and technological intelligence. We have a natural affinity for things electronic. We excel in technology and science generally. We tend to shy away from the ugly and muddy and messy sides of human intelligence. Our British friends are much more balanced. With the Clinton administration, we started to cut back dramatically on human intelligence. We are fascinated by technology, and I think that's one reason we haven't been able to prevent mischief-making, But it's one reason that we tend to obsess about the electronic side. I don't think I'm overstating the case.
So let me see if I get what you're saying correctly. You're saying our interest in technology in the spy game comes at the expense of the old-fashioned human being spy element?
No, I'm sorry. I obviously wasn't clear enough, and maybe perhaps you're helping to make my point. I think human espionage and occasionally sabotage is just as important. We had some celebrated spy cases during the Cold War, a couple during World War II. Our British friends had much more trouble with defectors and double agents. But since the end of the Cold War, the FBI and the CIA, which were basically penetration-free during the Cold War, they both had problems with notorious spies who did a tremendous amount of damage. In 2010, the reason why Mr. Skripal and his daughter, the Russian double agent who worked for the British, was poisoned in Britain. He was part of an exchange in 2010, spy ring of something like a dozen spies in the United States were sent back to Russia. Now, human espionage and human intelligence is very, very active. It's not as sexy and it's not as easy to address in the media as electronic intelligence, but the point I'm trying to make is it's still there, still very real. I think we can learn a lot from our British friends for all the problems they've had. I think they maintain a much better balance. And they've been at it for several hundred years longer than we have.
A much better balance between the human part and the technological part.
Yeah, exactly. And they inspired American intelligence. FDR, early in World War II, well before Pearl Harbor, sent a fascinating man, Bill Donovan, a ferocious Irish politician. Unfortunately for him, he happened to be a Republican. He did very well in the law, but he became the agent of the White House in Britain and in other parts of Europe throughout the war. The British intelligence inspired the OSS, which evolved to the CIA. There is a very fine portrait of Mr. Donovan still at the entryway of the CIA headquarters in Langley.
You mentioned Britain and the Skripal affair, if you will. There have been people arrested in that case, and Vladimir Putin himself and the Putin administration have gone to great pains to say, you know, they've arrested just normal people and they couldn't have had anything to do with this. What's at stake from the Russian British relationship? How does it play into the larger Russia versus the West issue?
I think it's much more Russia versus the West than the British. Russians tend to use heavy-handed and crude methods. I don't think they're generally as sophisticated. They're very good at trapping, including a notorious honey trap during the Cold War, but up till today, where someone might be compromised, someone who's vulnerable, taken advantage of in personal terms, to put it politely. But in terms of really sophisticated intelligence, they're not that great, historically or currently. Nonetheless, they are good enough to poison someone and most likely kill them using means that are not nearly so easily detected as the nerve agent that almost killed Mr. Skripal and his daughter. Fortunately, they survived, as did a police officer who went to their aid and was also stricken with discarded poison. Two other quite innocent Brits, a couple of months later, were stricken, and a woman died. This is so obvious that my guess is that Putin and associates wanted this to be identified with them.
It sends a message.
They could do a better job. Yeah, if they wanted to carry out a hit, it would work, and they could do it more subtly. It sends a message, you're right, to current agents, of which there are a lot in this country and elsewhere. Be careful. Don't think twice before betraying us. And those currently in Russia in their orbit.
Why might they have done that in the UK versus presumably they know of double agents in this country?
That's a very good point. Britain tends to be more of a safe refuge for people in Skripal situation than other places. There have been a whole series of killings and just in the last two decades in Britain. I think we have avoided carrying out obvious attacks, assaults, and killings in each other's countries because it might escalate more quickly. That's my best guess. There isn't one good answer, but I think both sides show a lot of restraint toward the others, just as generally the government of Israel and their various opponents. They've killed each other, but they don't do it in the U.S. They rarely do it in Europe. They prefer to kill each other elsewhere.
There's another country that's been in the news in recent days that I don't think we have ever had cause to address in one of our conversations.
Oh, my goodness.
There were national...
Well, we must address it at once.
Exactly.
Maybe go there.
Yeah, exactly. That would be maybe for the next one of these. We'll go on site for the interview. There were national elections in Sweden in recent days, and the storyline that came out of those elections seemed to be in part about the declining power of centrists and the middle, and increasing power on the polls, especially the right-wing side and the more liberal side. Is this kind of a metaphor for where we are around the world at this point?
It is. Yes, you're right in the sense that right-wing parties and parties that can be called neo-fascist, even neo-Nazi, in different parts of Europe have been doing better. And we generally tend to overreact to this. Marie Le Pen and her father in France, who have done very well in presidential elections, have not won. But we immediately start looking to imagery of the Third Reich and Vichy France and that sort of thing. It's a similar phenomenon, and you can see it in Hungary and Austria. Other places, mostly smaller countries. In Germany, the growth of a far-right party, much more understandably, is a source of concern. But these countries all remain functioning democracies. The case of Sweden is distinctive. Historically, again, going far back in history, referring to the British earlier, Scandinavia has had relatively stable, law-abiding, representative governments, our kind of systems. The Swedes have been a problem in the sense that during the Cold War, they were particularly self-righteous and sanctimonious in lecturing our government and our citizens individually, including me when I was a student many years ago. A lot of countries, including our good friends in Canada, welcomed American draft evaders during the Vietnam War and anti-war activists who were in trouble with the government, our government. The Swedes welcomed deserters, to their great cost, a very different population and violent. Crime went up dramatically, but that's very Swedish in those days. We are holier than you, certainly. They've had to put up with a lot of challenges. They're a homogeneous, rich country that has not tolerated foreign immigrants, especially those who are not Nordic in appearance, to put it politely. The assassination of Olof Palme way back in 1986, I think, was a psychic blow to them collectively. My gosh, we're not as not only not as pure, but not as safe as we thought we were. And they're kind of working through that. But we have two very good allies right next door on either side. Norway, a traditional good friend of the United States with a strong cultural impact in this part of the country, as has Sweden. But in the case of Norway, it's worked out much more to our advantage and theirs. And Finland, which is technically a neutral country, but a ferocious country militarily. They fought the Red Army to a standstill in the Winter War of 40-41. It was not a negotiated settlement. The Winter War of 39-40, it was not a negotiated. It was a negotiated settlement. They're technically neutral because they're right on Russia's border, but they're very, very friendly to us. Norway is a member of NATO. Given the fact that Putin's been making aggressive moves toward the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, I think we're well served by the strategic environment in Scandinavia. And to actually answer your question, I think this extremist development in Sweden, where the center-left and center-right traditional coalitions, they finished the last election in a dead heat. They're still trying to work out a government. They might have to work with the Swedish Democrats, who are really a far-right party and have, I think, 67 seats. That's actually very healthy.
Well, the other thing...
education. You know, like a professor who's suddenly confronted with a real-world situation that he can't cope with.
Of course, one of the other truths here is that governing looks a lot different in a country with three or four or five or six viable political parties than it does in a place like the United States, which basically has two.
Absolutely. Institutionally, they have parliamentary systems, and our legislative executive relationships are constitutionally quite different. That's a very good point. We maintain a stable two-party system. I'm not entirely sure why. I don't think anyone is. even though academics, quite rightly, spend a lot of time studying and analyzing the situation. We've had significant third-party threats in this country. Ross Perot got a lot of votes, most recently, I think, in the 90s. Pat Buchanan did not get a lot of votes in 2000. We've got lots of parties, but only two are dominant. The last time a third party really came close to holding a whip hand, a la the current situation in Sweden, was in 1968, where George Wallace came within a hair's breadth. He came within literally tens of thousands of votes of throwing the election into the House of Representatives. The Democratic nominee, Hubert Humphrey, the Republican nominee, Richard Nixon. Nixon won just barely. For a while, Hubert Humphrey was behind Nixon by 40 points, and it looked like Wallace was going to overtake him. In that tremendously turbulent, violent year, the Great Republic owes a debt of gratitude to Vice President Humphrey, who was such a fantastic politician. He was able to come from behind. But Wallace, nonetheless, came very, very close. Another 10,000 votes in Tennessee and 50,000 in Ohio, I think, the other way, and Wallace would have had the whip hand.
Always comes down to Ohio.
Well, yeah. Otto von Bismarck, one of my favorite quotes, which unfortunately apparently is not accurate. He never said it, but I wish he had. The good Lord takes care of fools, drunkards, and the United States of America. Widows and orphans and the United States of America.
One of your favorite apocryphal quotes.
Yes, yeah. But it sounds like him, and it was also very insightful. Our two-party system is just incredible, but it keeps stability despite all the chaos, which our media focus on quite rightly all the time.
Art's here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's also a regular Lake Effect contributor.
We will take a quick break now and then have the latest episode of our series on how successful entrepreneurs built their businesses. How Did You Do That is next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's time now for our regular series on business and entrepreneurship.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is executive director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded. Sue Marks understood the idea of entrepreneurship and a strong work ethic from a very young age. Her grandparents immigrated from Germany in 1919 with nothing, but built a life for themselves in Milwaukee. Her grandfather owned a small printing business. Sue's example was a grandfather who left for work before 6 o'clock every morning. Sue got married at 19 and finished college at night and earned a BS in business administration from Marquette University. She has never stopped working.
Sue's founder and CEO of Cielo, a fast-growing recruitment process outsourcing firm that has 1,800 employees and about $200 million of annual revenue. She previously founded ProStaff and HR First, which she sold in 2000 to a Fortune 500 staffing firm. She's also been an investor or on boards of a number of tech and tech-enabled service companies. Sue, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thanks, Tim and Kathleen. Good to be with you.
Hey, Sue, you started your first companies, ProStaff and HR First, in 1980. Tell us how you came to do that.
Well, I guess I thought I could do it better than the existing providers and had an example in my father and grandfather as an entrepreneur. So I figured I'd give it a try and put a plan together and The rest is ancient history right now.
After you sold ProStaff and HR First, you decided to do it all over again and form Pinstripe, which you rebranded in 2014 to Cielo. You could have relaxed on a beach. What made you want to do it again?
I ask myself that every once in a while, as as I think probably most entrepreneurs do, if they are totally honest. We were, as HR First, very early in the emergence of what is now called recruitment process outsourcing. And what we do as an RPO company is essentially become the corporate talent acquisition or corporate recruiting department for large companies around the world. So essentially, headquartered in Brookfield, Wisconsin, with our rest of world headquarters in London, we operate the corporate recruiting departments for about 130 companies around the world. We were so early in the space back with ProStaff and HR First that as I thought about going back into the business, technology had changed, HR departments and business needs had gotten so much more sophisticated. There was a lot of runway left in that industry and a lot of room for innovation in the industry. So we've always applied a technology platform to ourselves as a service business, which was quite different than most of our competitors who didn't use technology, just used lots of people.
So Sue, I want you to be honest. I think I remember you telling me once that you had also forgotten how much work it was the first time.
Absolutely. Forgot how much work it was the first time around. Yep. One of my old banking friends and actually supporters and mentors said to me, "Are you sure you want to do this? It's going to take you a little bit to get back in the saddle." And he was absolutely right.
You invented this space called recruitment process outsourcing. I just want to back up a little. What made you think of it, of becoming the HR department for a company?
Well, first, I think there's probably three or four of us that could reasonably say we invented what has now come to be known as recruitment process outsourcing, which is a specialized subset of business process outsourcing. I was in the traditional contingency search and temporary staffing business, and we've got a great example of Manpower's World Headquarters right here. So I was in that business, and I thought, wow, our clients don't really do this very well. And one of the reasons they need so much of us as recruiters, external recruiters and temporary help services, is they don't do it very well. I know how to run staffing like a business. And I heard a presentation by a tech speaker. Tech is the executive committee and executive agenda. And he talked about turning products into services and turning services into products. And he gave the example of Pitney Bowes, who sold in the old days mailing machines and then started outsourcing mailrooms. And that was ding. It made sense to me. And that's how we started.
So you know a lot about what's going on with recruiting today and with young people and all of that sort of thing. So what's changed in the recruiting market from the point of view of the person looking for some new opportunity?
What's changed in the world of recruiting, particularly today when we're at record high employment levels, record low unemployment levels, rising wages, real skill mismatches in terms of where the talent is and where the jobs are, it actually is the customers, the clients, the companies that as they're recruiting have to treat candidates like the consumers they are, not like, I can bring 30 people onto the bus and if they don't work out, I can go get 30 more. Talent is actually really valuable. And every CEO talks the talk and leadership teams talk the talk about talent. Not that many walk the walk very well. So skilled, highly skilled talent has a lot of options nowadays. And McKinsey wrote The War for Talent, what, Tim and Kathleen, 20 or 30 years ago? There's always been a war for the best talent. And actually right now we're back in a full-fledged war for talent in the United States, and really mostly globally.
One of the things you've always focused on in your businesses is customers and employees. And I know you have these, you're known for what they call Sue-isms. Many of them are about the importance of customers and employees. Can you talk about how you treat both groups?
Well, I think as businesses grow, it's easy to it's easy to move away from your customer and not and think more about your internal processes and becoming more efficient. And the minute a CEO and his or her leadership team loses that sense of the customer, the business will inevitably start to fall, because somebody else will think about that customer experience. And from the perspective of the employees, happy employees deliver great service to customers. And that's not just a Sueism. That is well documented over decades of studies and research that engaged, satisfied employees deliver better service to customers and retain customers. So there is a direct correlation between employee engagement and customer NPS scores and profitability.
NPS scores are?
Net Promoter Score, which is a very high standard of customer satisfaction, a Net Promoter Score. Tim, you asked earlier about what's changed in recruiting for candidates, and I said, well, it's changed for companies. It's gotten so much more competitive. What I'd say is all about mobile nowadays, and it's all about being as fast and as frictionless as clients can be, and because if they want to be first to the best talent, they have to provide an experience that is in the remote control of our lives, which is what I call the PDAs that we use, or the phones that we use, right? The devices that we use. They are with us 24/7, right? So think about the last time you applied for a job, you maybe used paper and pencil. Then people grew up needing to apply online. Now people are moving to wanting to apply on their mobile device. So most organizations haven't made that transition yet, and they need to, because that's where particularly the younger workforce is going. We buy everything on Amazon now, and we can buy it in 3 clicks on our PDA, right? So that's how we have to be able to engage with candidates, and how candidates want to engage with the recruiters and the hiring managers and the corporate representatives.
And if you're the candidate and you've got a good job that you've use this process to find, what's your advice about promotion and mobility versus working your way up? And how should people think about that? Or is there any standard answer to that?
I don't think there's a standard answer to that. There is some research that says a moderate amount of job changing results in a higher level of total lifetime compensation. I would say that you don't want to be 5 years with the same company in the same job. If you're moving vertically and horizontally within your organization and you're learning more and you're being compensated fairly at every move and your compensation is increasing at every move, that, you know, you probably are going to be okay. If you don't think you are, there are ample resources available now on the web and elsewhere for you to check how much you should be making. And rather than go out and look for a new job, I would just go talk to my leader and my HR department, and I'd say, I've done my research and here's what I'm worth, and I'd ask for a raise. Then if you don't get one, yeah, and I know the show isn't about giving career advice, but there's so much transparency out there now that as corporate leaders and HR leaders, it's tougher to be in business than it ever has been. Everything is so transparent. Change happens so quickly. Hard to keep up.
So I think there is a big part of you that is a startup founder at heart, but you're now running an organization that has 1,800 employees. How do you maintain the entrepreneurial atmosphere, keep the right level of systems in place, but stay entrepreneurial?
Yeah. Well, we talk a lot about that. We talk about staying small as we get big. We remain in regional P&Ls rather than going to be global organizations. And we've attracted people that, whether they've worked at large companies or small, whether they've had large staffs and have been where we're going, which is some of what we need to do now as we're growing, is hire people that have been where we're going. They have an entrepreneurial bent. And so they really appreciate the opportunity to work with an organization that has scale. It's big enough to have scale and resources and market importance, but small enough that they can still actually make things happen quickly, put their own mark on it, and help us create the future that we're going to move the company into.
So, Sue, lots of our listeners are probably very interested in how you can manage this kind of success with the wonderful family I know you have. So what have you learned about how you do that?
First I'll say that it doesn't happen without a supportive spouse or partner and family, extended family. It doesn't happen without really great leaders throughout our organization and learning to trust and delegate. So it takes a great management team, and it takes a really understanding family. I often get asked about work-life balance, and I say that the balance word has never worked for me. I've always used the word blend. And since an early age, I've brought work home, and I've brought my kids to work. And I've taken my kids on trips. And then when I had to go on trips alone, it was like, oh, yeah, I've been to New York City with Mom. I'm okay with it. And now Skype and FaceTime makes all of those things so much easier.
So now you've had such success starting two what became very large organizations. What was your biggest challenge in all this, or how did you get through the bad moments?
I think we've been more successful than some companies and less than others. So being a lifelong learner and being confident but humble is actually really important. And our story is still being written. I mean, yes, we're a fairly large company now, but there's many that are much larger in our space. So we have lots of runway to continue to innovate and grow and provide great jobs for people, great career paths for people, and great solutions for our companies, for our customers, who need them more than ever in the kind of competitive environment we are, both for their customers and for the talent that they want to hire. I think the key thing is, as long as I continue to learn and grow and have a leadership team, and that leadership team has leaders beneath them, that we're all learning and growing, and we're authentic and transparent, and we understand that what got us from 0 to 50 and what got us from 50 to 150 or 200 isn't going to get us to 400 or 500, and we make those adjustments and bring those new people onto the team, that we're open to that. That's how we'll continue to overcome the challenges that we'll face. Because with growth comes complexity, and complexity kills the entrepreneurial spirit in businesses. And one in 17,000 organizations gets to $500 million. And I'm not sure that's where we're going, but, you know, we'd like to be at least one in 10,000, if not one in 17,000.
So I know you believe it's the job of an entrepreneur to be optimistic. Mm-hmm. You must have had moments where you thought, I can't do this, or this isn't going to work. How do you deal with that?
You have resources that can help, that have been where you've been, that would understand when you're feeling like, did I really blow this? And I need somebody to say, well, yeah, you did, but just dust yourself off and go say you're sorry or go fix it, right? So I think that having a network of advisors and mentors is really important. And having a supportive family, being able to be somewhat transparent with your leadership team. But I guess I'd say that you also need to be strong for your organization, even when you're not feeling strong. Because I've gone through several recessions, right? It's not easy to do that. And you need to be able to steer the ship through those rocks and make sure that the organization and all of your stakeholders have confidence in your leadership and in your leadership team. So I think being confident and humble and authentic enough to admit when you've made a mistake or admit when you need help are the most important things.
So to wrap up, tell us, what's the best thing that's happened to you on your entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah, I like to think it hasn't happened yet. It's been great to see people that I've worked with that are still with Cielo over more than a decade, you know, whether it's, you know, 3 years or a decade, the growth that they've had, or whether they've left our organization and have achieved a level of success. I really like to think that I'm so proud that we had a small part in their development. But I also think that the best hasn't yet happened.
We're lucky to have a role model like you in the community, Sue. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kathleen and Tim.
Thank you, and be sure to listen to our other podcasts at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you'd like to suggest ideas for future episodes of How Did You Do That, go to WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then chat with the project manager for Sculpture Milwaukee as the public art exhibit heads into the last month of its second season. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Sculpture Milwaukee is a month away from wrapping up its second year of art installations along Wisconsin Avenue. This year, it was bracketed on one end by Robert Indiana's iconic Love sculpture, that was on the east, and Anna Pravachka's Stealing Shadows, Michelangelo, to the west.
The exhibition runs through the 21st of October, but planning is already underway for year number three, and that will be installed next spring. Mary Lou Canode is the project director for Sculpture Milwaukee, and she joins us in the studio now. Mary Lou, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We are wrapping up a second year of Sculpture Milwaukee. Launched last year with great fanfare. It was fun to watch the sculptures go in and people interact with them. How has the second year gone? There's always a potential of a second year letdown.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right, Bonnie, but I think that we've done a great job of figuring out what our systems are, because the public sees the artwork. They don't know what's going on behind the scenes. And I would say that this year we had a really great diversity of artworks. I think the feedback from the public has been really great. One thing people have said is, wow, the works aren't quite as big. Well, we have two works that are almost 14,000 pounds. So technically, from our perspective, absolutely they're as big. But also there's a nuance to the kind of work that we're borrowing, you know, which artists are dealing with really contemporary issues that maybe has some resonance for the city of Milwaukee. And that's one of the things that we were looking at this year. I'm really proud of all the volunteers that we have working with us, all the donors, the team members. Everybody's done a really fantastic job. I would say that internally we've really done some great improvements this year. And externally, I think that we've done a great deal of outreach that I think has been really very, very successful.
Yeah, the first year, it's the excitement of the new.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my gosh, what's going up on Wisconsin Avenue? And people were watching things being installed and also being taken down at the end of the year. And so this year, it's like, oh, more sculptures going up, fine. But it seems like there is more infrastructure behind it now to help people engage with it. You know, I've seen tours. And I know you probably had those the first year, but it seemed like this year there were more of them. And I was seeing like docents walking around. It's almost like going into an art museum and having a docent lead you through stuff.
Absolutely. And actually, one of our key partners last year was the Milwaukee Art Museum and their docent program. So, you know, we were doing tours, weekly tours last year. We're doing them again this year. I think that we've added a lot more infrastructure around that. We also have a lot of other groups that we're working with who are doing tours. Is Historic Milwaukee. We've got a different range of educational partners, too. Giselle Studio, True School, Exfabula. And so we have actually seen a proliferation of people on the avenue enjoying the artwork, but looking at it from a lot of different perspectives. So, you know, Milwaukee Art Museum docents, they're interpreting the work, but they're really representing who is this artist? You know, what's their background? Exfabula is an incredible set of conversations about personal responses to artwork. And the storytellers talk about the works and how they respond to it, but they also get the public to engage, too. I heard some really amazing, heartfelt, really sweet, tender stories when I went through a couple of works with Exfabula team. They were really great to work with. So there's no doubt about the fact that we've diversified the kinds of audiences that we're addressing, you know, children, youth, adults, teens, college students. So I feel like we've really expanded how it is that we're serving the public, really.
So It seems like this is going to be a permanent annual thing. Is that the hope?
That's our hope.
Yeah.
And, you know, from the first year to the second, there was a lot of question about, well, let's evaluate our success. What was our budget really looking like? You know, how were our volunteers reacting to it? And what's the capacity of the funders in town? And so when we launched the second year, it wasn't really until January. This year, we're starting actually in October. We're going to be starting to work on things much sooner than we did last year. So I'm really proud to say that I think everybody feels that there's a real important value this has to our community, to our city, to the downtown. And we really are looking at launching something that's for the future. I think we've all been very spoiled in Milwaukee with all the great institutions that were founded in the 50s and 60s and 70s. This is about us looking to the future, too.
One of the things that both years have focused on is an international reach. You've looked to artists from all over the world, but you've also focused on Milwaukee artists, too. How committed are you making sure that in the future more Milwaukee artists get put on the avenue?
Well, we are always committed to that. Finding artists who can deal with public art and the mechanics behind that, not everybody does that. And so that's one of the things that we're working on developing, broader network. But we've also broadened the kinds of artists that we're dealing with this year. We're dealing with storytellers and performance artists and musicians. And so it's not just visual artists that we're working with. It's all these other people in this in the great, broad, and rich community that we've got in Milwaukee.
I think it's a really great idea to, you know, to expand what public art is. And we tend to think of an installation. We think of sculpture. Even if it's kinetic, we think of something permanent that's sitting there. But that can be people, too.
Absolutely. That's actually a great point. And, you know, public art has changed a lot. I mean, public art is all around us. And I would hazard a guess that everything that we see in our urban environment is designed by someone. So, therefore, everything is art in some ways. Buildings are art. The street design is by people who are thinking about flow, et cetera, et cetera. And public artists are really considering what would really engage people in very different parts of their brain. So you're right, guy on horse, mermaid in fountain, those are really very typical and traditional forms of art. And let's think about, what does a piece of music mean? Does it highlight the other sounds that are around us? What about something that's fleeting as opposed to something that's permanent? And so these are really new genres of public art. It sometimes can be confusing to the public, which is used to guys on horses. And so this is really part of the educational role that we have, which is discussing the things that have been going on in the arts for the last 30, 40 years and bringing them to Milwaukee and highlighting what exists here, too. So I think it's a really great benefit and balance that we're trying to strike between really great contemporary global art and then what's really unique to the city of Milwaukee.
So how do you and Russell work together? You're both co-curators of this, and I know he was at the Milwaukee Art Museum for a long time. He's now based in Chicago. How are you guys working on that part of it?
Well, you know, both Russell and I have been working, of course, in different roles in the arts for a very, very long time. I've actually just returned to Milwaukee. I was the director of a sculpture park in St. Louis, but I used to be at UWM, in fact. So Russell and I have access to different parts of the art world. We have very common attitudes, though. You know, when you're in the arts, you think about what are best practices because, of course, like any field, you know, there are plenty of standards that we hold to as well. And as nonprofit people, you know, we're really dedicated to, you know, what is the public benefit, best practices for, you know, really stewarding the resources that people give to us. So I think our underpinning ideas are very, very similar. Now, that being said, we have different access to the art worlds. Russell knows a great deal of blue chip artists. He's worked with people in New York more than I have in some ways. I've worked a lot with Europeans, you know, North African artists. So I think that we have great complementary skills. Our conversations, though, are a lot of fun. I always really enjoy, you know, when you get a colleague who really understands a shorthand, it's really a lot of fun. But we're really very deliberate about representing different generations of artists. For example, this year we have Robert Indiana, who's been well known since the 1960s, really major artist, just passed away, but a major artist who has had huge impact on the arts for 50 years. And then we have younger artists like Shana McCaw and Brent Budsberg, who are two artists locally who we commissioned to do their first outdoor artwork like this. So I feel like we really have great interest in figuring out, you know, how do these artists work together? What are the great points of contact they have? But also, how are these artists commenting on the world in which we live?
Well, I also imagine that as you're thinking about who you're going to ask to do this, how they talk to each other mm-hmm. along the street, or do they? Are they in opposition? How are they interacting? Not just people, but the artworks themselves. And so am I right in that? Are you, the two of you sitting down saying, how are these things going to work together?
Absolutely. But also, you know, how do they comment on the city and contemporary society? So a lot of the works that we have are really framing the architecture of the city in very specific ways. The John Henry, for example, when you circumnavigate the piece, he's really framing the city like little films still. So every angle looks very, very different and distinct. When you think about Hank Willis Thomas, his work, which is about the role of sports stars in contemporary society and enshrining their role for us, he's thinking about the social infrastructure of the world that we live in. Some of these artists are talking about physical space. Some of them are talking about social space. Some of them are talking about political space. And so all contemporary artists, for me, great contemporary artists, really tell us something about the world we live in that we maybe aren't seeing ourselves, that the news media can't give us. They're representing something that we maybe will have resonance for. So when you look at Hank Willis Thomas, by golly, we've got a new, you know, sports arena for the Bucks to play in. How does that not sort of speak to the role basketball plays in our community? Robert Indiana, you know, people who saw the old Mecca know that Robert Indiana did the floor there many, many years ago in a work commissioned by Steve Marcus. So there's a great circle that comes around to us. And so this is what we're trying to do with our educational materials, you know, really give the public those links, those points of contact where you can see, well, this artist has their own career, but also how does it reflect our life in Milwaukee? So there is sort of across Wisconsin Avenue ebbs and flows, these little eddies of connection, and it's like seeing a double feature of a movie. You know, there are little connections that you can make in your own mind, too.
Is there ever a thought, as I know you've only had 2 years so far, to expand it out beyond Wisconsin Avenue, take in other neighborhoods, and somehow connect them all together? Is that in the future plan?
Well, I think that we would all love to see that happen. I think our priority is really to use this artwork to enliven the downtown area. There, you know, we have Steve Marcus as our founder, but our other founder, our umbrella organization, is Milwaukee Downtown Inc., Bid 21. And Beth Wierick and her team have been enormously helpful in helping us understand, you know, all the things that they're doing downtown to make it more alive. Like many cities across the country, they're really reinvesting in the urban core of our cities. And then down the road, we're really hoping to connect to other parts of the community. We've had conversations with other people. I think we need to really, really get this all nailed down and then expand our capacity, which really means having more people involved with what it is that we're doing. We're a very, very small crew. I think our ambitions are huge. The expectations are large. But, you know, it takes a lot of people to actually execute the things that happen in a museum or this kind of, you know, art program. So, you know, that's our goal. But I think we need to really take it one step at a time, too.
Oh, sure. You don't want to overextend yourself
right
before you've even really gotten off the ground.
That's right. So the learning curve from last year to this year was really amazing. You know, both Russell and I have worked in the arts for a very long time. All of our team members have incredible skills. I feel enormously lucky. We work with the City Department of Public Works. We work with KEI Landscaping, who's helping us determine how to use the flower beds. We're working with Open Roads, who's helping us with our permitting. Still in all, we have to think about, are the sidewalks hollow underneath this? And so when you have a 14,000-pound artwork, you can only put it in so many places.
Yes.
You know, where can the cranes go? You know, we can't be on the streets with a crane until after 9 o'clock so we don't impede traffic. All these really incredible learning curves. I would say that we're all much taller. The learning curve was great. We've all grown. So this year we're really looking at, so what can we do with the resources we've got, and how do we grow those resources, and how do we support all of the volunteers, our marketing folks, our design folks, our website folks. You know, so it's been really very complicated. We want to make sure that we've got those all really rock solid, and then we can start to experiment and do even some crazier things than we did the last 2 years.
Well, that'll be cool.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that. When do we start getting the idea of what's coming up next year? When are you going to start announcing those artists?
Well, so Russell and I have been working on this already for about a month and a half. Lots of artists last year we couldn't get. You know, you can't always get the things you want. We can't always get what you want.
As the Rolling Stones so famously said.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So, you know, what's really interesting, Bonnie, behind all of this is the fact that public sculpture is now a huge, huge part of the art world. I would say 40 years when the first sculpture parks in the country were being formed, there were not that many artists doing large outdoor sculpture. Today, almost every museum has an outdoor sculpture park. And now a lot of private collectors are actively buying sculpture for their own collections, for their public parks that they fund, for their own backyards. So there's a great deal of competition for what it is that we're doing. And so, you know, we've done a lot of research, but not everything is available. Also, sculpture is much, much more expensive than a painting. A painting can be very expensive, don't get me wrong. But sculpture is really expensive. It's expensive to ship. It's expensive to install. You know, there's so many different things that go into this. Also, public art has to be fairly durable. A bird can do droppings on top of your artwork, but we don't want people to climb on artwork. How do we protect the artwork from inappropriate interaction? So we've been looking at lists of people that we had left over from last year we weren't quite able to get, and we've got a whole nother list of people this year for all the research that two of us have been doing. So we've already been doing outreach to lenders. We've been talking to some artists. We're doing some studio visits. I'm hoping we'll have, maybe by February, we'll have a really confirmed list, or at least a partial confirmed list. So, and that's about where we were last year, too. So we're working right now.
It sounds terrific. And, of course, we will talk once the list is finalized and, you know, hopefully get some artists in the studio this time.
Great. Perfect.
Would be great.
Yeah.
So, Mary Lou, I want to thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on two successful years.
Thanks.
And here's to many more to come.
Lovely.
I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you so much, Bonnie. And I just want to thank everybody who's been so supportive of Sculpture Milwaukee.
Mary Lou Canode is the project manager for Sculpture Milwaukee. The second season installment is on display along Wisconsin Avenue through late October.
And on tomorrow's show, we'll feature a conversation with one of the artists that Mary Lou mentioned, former Bucks player Desmond Mason. He's both a painter and a sculptor. He'll be back in town this week to give a lecture about one of the pieces in this year's Sculpture Milwaukee, Hank Willis Thomas's Liberty. That's tomorrow on Lake Effect. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the show. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.